Has he been served? I'm sure you'll be stunned to hear we've been unable to locate him. You wouldn't happen to know where he's staying, would you? Costello deflected the pointed question with a humorless laugh. Ellen, your paranoia is reaching new heights if you believe I'm hiding a witness from you. She took the verbal shot and pressed on, immune to his attempts to hurt her. How is it you've spoken to him while the cops can't even find him? That might have something to do with the caliber of cops you're working with. You underestimate them, Tony, and I think you underestimate me, which is fine. It'll be all the more gratifying when I kick your ass next week. You're overestimating your case, Ellen, he said, and you're grasping at straws going after Wright's phone records. You can't believe you'll find anything linking Dr. Wright to the kidnapping, which means you're really looking for something else. I'm surprised Judge Grabko didn't call you on it. Actually, I don't expect to find anything at all, she admitted coolly. I don't expect to find your phone number listed under calls placed on the 25th, for instance, which will mean that Karen Wright didn't call you on behalf of her husband. And if Karen Wright didn't call you, then who did? So we're back to that conspiracy theory. You know, maybe you need help for this, Ellen, although I'm sure our mutual friend Mr. Brooks will find your psychological quirks an interesting added facet for his book. Mutual friend? She asked, the cool disinterest in her tone completely at odds with what she was feeling. I've barely met the man, she lied. How do you know him? What did he know? Did he know about Jay's connection to the Attorney General? He had a private investigator working the case. Did he know Brooks had taken her home last night? Would he try to make an issue of it? I met him years ago, actually, he answered casually. We were both at Purdue, though we were several years apart. Small world, isn't it? Ellen felt the floor dip beneath her feet. Brooks knew Costello. They had gone to the same college. He had never said one word. Ellen, are you all right? Costello asked. You look a little pale. Don't worry about it, Tony. She spurred herself to move, to turn away, to duck her head. It's nothing the truth won't cure. She hefted her briefcase onto the other counsel table and stuffed the disclosure into the appropriate file folder. You don't have to concern yourself about my mental state, unless, of course, I'm right. And your client's accomplice called you in on this case, thereby making you an accessory in the Holloman kidnapping. She clicked the locks closed and gave her adversary a final, challenging stare. As an officer of the court, I'm sure I don't have to remind you of your obligation to report Todd Childs's whereabouts to the police, should you happen to see him. Who knows? Maybe we can kill two birds with one stone, serve our witness and nail an accomplice all in one shot. Wouldn't that be nice and neat? Only two birds? He questioned. I thought you were after my head, too. Oh, I am, Tony, she said with a nasty smile. You'll be my bonus dead duck. He stepped close enough that she could smell the expensive aftershave he wore and lowered his head as if to share a secret. It's so nice to know you still think of me as special, he murmured. God, she hated that he thought he could manipulate her with memories and sex appeal. Special isn't how I think of you, Tony. You're at the wrong end of the adjective spectrum altogether. Does that mean you won't have dinner with me for old time's sake after all this is said and done? He asked, his tone still intimate, his expression hungry and amused. I'd rather have my limbs gnawed off. He had the nerve to laugh and the gall to hold the door for her as they left the courtroom. They were mobbed as soon as they stepped into the hall, a dozen voices shouting questions at once. Bodies pressed in on them, hands thrusting forward with microphones and tape recorders. Ellen found herself trapped at Costello's side, her shoulder brushing against his arm. As she was jostled, she had to steady herself with a hand against the small of his back. She hated to touch him. Our mutual friend, Mr. Brooks.
Miss North, is it true you've been threatened?
We were both at Purdue.
Miss North, are there any suspects in the vandalism?
Small world, isn't it? Mr. Costello, does Dr. Wright have any comment on possible involvement of the sci-fi cowboys in the attack on Ms. North? Mr. Costello, is it true you're pushing for the investigation to turn toward Paul Kirkwood?
My client is innocent,
Costello shouted, fixing his eagle glare just to the left of a portable sun gun.
The police have been negligent in pursuing leads that might take their investigation in a direction they don't want to consider. My investigators have pursued all leads. I can guarantee you that when the hearing begins next week, Dr. Garrett Wright will not be the only one on trial.
The statement had the effect of pouring gasoline on a fire. The noise level rose to a deafening din. Wanting nothing more than to escape, Ellen positioned her briefcase to use as shield and battering ram and started against the current of the crowd.
Ms. North, do you have any comment? Ms. North, can we get a statement?
She lowered her head and pushed forward, slamming the briefcase into someone's knees. Down the hall, the door to Judge Witt's courtroom opened, and the old bailiff, Randolph Grimm, barged into the hall shouting for quiet, his face as red as a cherry tomato.
Keep it down out here! Court is in session! Don't you people have any respect?
Without waiting for an answer, he raised his cane and smacked it against the wall, the sound ringing out like a gunshot. People ducked and gasped and swung toward him. Cameramen wheeled with tape running. Ellen took advantage of the diversion to make her escape, rounding a jungle gym of scaffolding and riding a service elevator down to the second floor. Costello was going to turn the spotlight on Paul. Theoretically, the ploy would have no bearing on the probable cause hearing. Grabko had to base his decision whether or not to bind Wright over for trial on the evidence presented, and Tony had no real evidence against Paul Kirkwood. But there wouldn't be a potential juror in the district who wouldn't have picked up on a story as sensational as this.
You have to get it to a jury first, Ellen,
she muttered, as the elevator landed and the doors pulled open. Phoebe stood outside the county clerk's office, with a ream of paperwork clutched to her meager bosom, and a shy smile on her face, absorbed in conversation with the boy wonder of the Grand Forks Herald. Adam Slater's eyes widened as he caught sight of Ellen. He swung away from Phoebe, digging a notepad out of the hip pocket of his baggy jeans.
Hey, Ms. North, can I ask you a couple of questions about last night?
I'm surprised you weren't upstairs with the rest of the pack. Slater shook his head.
Can't get anywhere that way. Everyone will have the same story. If I want to make my mark, I've got to get something fresh. You know, like they say in baseball, hit 'em where they ain't.
Charming analogy, Ellen said. But I don't want you swinging your bat around my secretary. Is that understood, Mr. Slater? His smile went flat. Beside him, Phoebe stood with her jaw dropped and her cheeks tinting.
I have no comment for your story, Ellen went on. You'll have to use someone else to make your mark. Phoebe, let's go. We've got work to do.
She started toward the office, but turned back when Phoebe didn't fall in step behind her. The girl had ducked her head in abject embarrassment.
God, I'm really sorry, Adam. I didn't...
Phoebe,
Ellen said sharply.
Man, this sucks,
Slater complained, flopping his arms at his sides.
We were just talking.
Phoebe kept her head down as she walked beside Ellen. Neither spoke. In the outer offices, phones rang, and Kevin O'Neill, the county SWAT commander, stood talking and laughing with Sig Iverson and Quentin Adler.
Hey, Ellen,
O'Neill called as he caught sight of her.
The ATF caught your pals the Burger Boys down in Tennessee.
Was there gunplay?
She asked with sadistic hope.
Gave up without a fight and with a van full of stolen cigarettes. ATF wants to keep them on the federal beef. What do you want to do about extradition?
Ellen shook her head.
Good riddance. Save the county some money.
She turned around just as Phoebe was slinking behind her desk.
I'd like to speak with you in my office.
The girl didn't answer, but followed Ellen as if going to her death.
How do you know Adam Slater?
Ellen asked, as soon as they were in the office.
I met him at the Leaf and Bean last night,
she said quietly, still hugging her papers.
We drank coffee and listened to music. Thursday is open mic night.
Did you know he was a reporter?
Yes, he said so. We didn't talk about the case, Ellen. I know better. I know you wouldn't mean to say anything, Phoebe, but he's a reporter. They have ways of wheedling information out of people. Believe me, I know.
Our mutual friend, Mr. Brooks.
I was very upfront with him about it, Phoebe said. I told him right off I couldn't say anything about the case, and he was fine with that. Maybe he just wanted to have coffee with me. Maybe he just likes me as a human being. Our psyches are very in tune.
Ellen rolled her eyes. Oh, please, Phoebe, he's a reporter, looking to make a name for himself. He'll do anything to get what he wants. That's what reporters do. They screw people over for their own glorification.
I'm here for a story. I go after what I want, and I get it.
Well, I'm sorry I'm not as cynical and paranoid as you are.
Tears beaded on Phoebe's lashes.
And I'm sorry you don't trust me, Ellen.
It's not you I don't trust, Ellen said softly. She let out a pent-up breath, trying without success to force the tension out of her shoulders. It's the rest of the world I don't trust, Adam Slater included. God, what a tangled mess. She took her secretary to task for talking to a cub reporter from a nothing newspaper in nowhere North Dakota, while J. Butler Brooks, renowned rogue and writer, old college buddy of her arch-nemesis, had been making himself at home in her home, drinking her liquor, kissing her, touching her, reaching past her barriers.
Who do you trust?
Phoebe? Adam Slater? Costello? Brooks? Trust no one.
Rumor has it you think Enberg had some help with that shotgun.
Where did you hear that?
Around.
If there's a leak on this case...
No one fed it to me. I don't have a mole in your office, if that's what you're worried about.
I'm not paranoid. If she was paranoid, it didn't mean they weren't out to get her. She stood at her window and looked out. Deer Lake was a ghost town. Wind-swept and deserted, a place from a science fiction movie, where all had been abandoned in an unknown moment for unknown reasons. Abandoned. It was a good word for what she was feeling, abandoned by the security and trust and safety she had embraced here.
"We can't take chances," she said, turning back toward Phoebe. "Look what happened with Paige Price and Steiger and that whole mess. This case is too important. We can't risk a mistake. Josh and Megan are counting on us."
"And Dustin Holloman," Phoebe added in a small voice.
She gnawed her lower lip for a moment of silence for the victims, then swiped a tear from her cheek.
"I'm so sorry. I wouldn't.
Ellen held up a hand. "I know you wouldn't, Phoebe. Just be careful. Please." She nodded and sniffled and pushed her glasses up on her nose.
"Cameron and Mitch and Agent Wilhelm are waiting for you in the conference room."
Ellen briefed them on the meeting in Grabko's chambers. Mitch reacted with anger, Cameron with disgust. Marty Wilhelm looked troubled and confused.
"Is abuse a possibility?" he asked.
"Absolutely not," Mitch said. "I've known Hannah and Paul since I moved here. There's no way."
"But Costello is right," Wilhelm argued. "Paul Kirkwood has a temper. We've seen it."
"Hannah would never allow him to hurt Josh. She wouldn't put up with that kind of shit for a minute."
"Then what's she doing married to the jerk? She doesn't strike me as the kind of woman who would put up with any of Paul Kirkwood's lesser qualities. But there she is. There might be a lot we don't know about their marriage."
"He's changed," Mitch said. "People do." Cameron arched a brow.
"The question may be, how much? Has he gone off the deep end? We know the marriage is all but over. Paul isn't living at the house. We know Josh reacted very badly when Paul showed up to see him in the hospital."
"And you think it's because he's a child abuser, and Hannah knows it, but has failed to report it," Mitch stated flatly.
"Stranger things have been proved true."
His face set in stubborn lines, Mitch turned his scowl from Cameron to Wilhelm and back.
"Use your heads.
We're saying Wright's accomplice nabbed Dustin Holloman. Nothing in that case points to Paul.
Maybe there are three of them, Wilhelm suggested.
Yeah, Mitch said. Maybe Deerlake has a whole underground community of psychotic child abusers, and they're all trying to draw suspicion off their pal Wright.
There's no point in fighting about this among ourselves, Ellen said. Costello is forcing the issue. If he's looking at Paul, then we'd better make at least a token show of looking at Paul, or we'll end up with egg on our faces.
There was the van, Wilhelm started. All together now.
Mitch raised his arms like a symphony conductor.
The van that yielded us nothing.
Mitch is right, Ellen said. Don't waste time on the van. Talk to people around Paul. Talk to his secretary. Talk to his partner.
He won't be any help pinning down Paul's movements in any way, Cameron said. I know Dave Christensen from my health club. He's been working strictly from home for the past 3 months. His wife is having a difficult pregnancy with twins.
Okay, so we talk again with the secretary, Wilhelm said, and the security guard at his office complex, neighbors, see what we can tie him to. Maybe he's not in with Wright. Maybe he's trying to frame Wright.
Mitch slapped his hands down on the table.
Jesus Christ! Costello would love this. We're here to discuss new evidence against his client, and instead, we're tripping over conspiracy theories. This isn't a case we're on, it's a fucking Oliver Stone movie.
Evidence? Ellen asked, sitting up straighter.
What evidence?
Wilhelm pushed a curled tube of fax paper across the table to her.
I pulled some strings and got a friend in the lab to release a preliminary report on some more of our physical evidence, the gloves, the ski mask, and the sheet that was wrapped around Agent O'Malley the night she was attacked.
And?
The glove has bloodstains that look to match Agent O'Malley for type. We already know about the blood types on the sheet. Now we're looking at hairs recovered from the sheet. Four distinct types. One unidentified, one consistent with Agent O'Malley, one consistent with Josh, and one consistent with Garrett Wright.
We finally catch a break, Ellen said,
a sense of relief seeping through her.
Regarding the stocking cap, Wilhelm went on, they found two distinct types of hair, one consistent with Wright, and one matching the unidentified hair found on the sheet.
The question now, he said, is who does that other hair belong to? And if we got a sample from Paul Kirkwood, would we get a match?
Chapter 21 Father Tom sat in a pew toward the back of the church. On the left-hand side of the aisle, opposite where his one-time deacon, Albert Fletcher, had fallen to his death 6 days ago. Albert, devout servant of the Lord, his faith turning into fanaticism, into madness, his madness leading him to his death, here, in this place he had loved. Tom couldn't decide if it was poetic or ironic. It was sad, he knew that, and it struck him as cruel, as many things did these days. He sat alone. The weather had kept the faithful few away from morning mass. He had gone through the motions for his own sake, hoping he would feel something, some kind of deep, binding affirmation that he still belonged in the vestments. But all he felt was hollow desperation, as if he were truly, totally, spiritually alone, abandoned by the same God who had allowed Josh to be taken, and Hannah to suffer, and Albert to die. He had considered confessing his feelings, but he already knew the empty platitudes that would be handed him in response. He was being tested. He needed to reflect, to pray. He needed to keep his faith. A pat on the head and 100 Hail Marys. At most, they would send him on retreat for a week or a month to one of the secluded spots where the church tucked away its embarrassments. The alcoholic priests, the burnouts, the mentally fragile, the sexually suspect. Time to reflect among the casualties, but not too long, because the archdiocese was woefully short of priests, and better to have one in place who had lost his faith than not to have one at all. At least, he could go through the motions. The politics of the church disgusted him, and always had.
He had come to the priesthood for better reasons, nobler reasons, reasons that were drifting away from him. He tipped his head back and looked up at the soaring ceiling, with its delicate gilt arches and ethereal frescoes. St. Ease had been built in the era when many cathedrals were still affordable, and parishioners tithed to the church instead of their IRAs. The exterior was of native limestone. Twin spires thrust heavenward like lances of the soldiers of God. The windows were stained glass works of art, jewel-tone mosaics depicting the life of Christ. Inside, the walls were painted slate blue and trimmed with lacework stencils in gilt and white and rose. The pews were oak, the kneelers padded with worn velvet. It was the kind of place meant to inspire awe and offer comfort, a place of ritual and wonderful mysteries. Miracles. He could have used one about now. Along the south wall, a rack of cobalt glass votives cradled the flames of 3 dozen prayers, filling the air with the buttery scent of melting wax. On the wall beside the tiers of candles, the handmade posters put up by the catechism classes praying for Josh's safety had been replaced with prayers for Dustin Holloman. Prayers children should never have to make. Fears their lives should never have known. In the silence, he could hear the memory of his father's voice as he read the Billings newspaper 3 days after the fact, because that was as fast as the mail could get it to them on their small ranch near Red Lodge, Montana. Every morning, Bob McCoy would come in from chores and read the paper while he had his breakfast, and shake his head and say, "The world's going to hell on a sled." Tom thought he could hear the runners screeching. But the thump that resounded in the church brought him back to reality, such as it was. Someone had come in the main doors at the back, the main doors that needed oil in their hinges. He turned in the pew, squinting to recognize the man walking toward him from the dark shadows beneath the balcony. "I'm looking for Father Tom McCoy." "I'm Father Tom," he said, rising. "J. Butler Brooks." "Ah, the crime writer," he said, offering his hand. Jay clasped the priest's hand in his and gave it a pump. "You're familiar with my work, Father?" "Only by reputation. My reading taste runs more toward fiction. I get enough reality on a daily basis. What can I do for you, Mr. Brooks?"
"I'd like a moment of your time, if I might. I wasn't interrupting anything, was I?"
Tom McCoy cast an ironic glance around the deserted church, but the emotion that twitched the corners of his mouth seemed self-deprecating. He looked nothing like any priest Jay had ever seen or imagined. He was too young, too handsome, built like an athlete, and dressed like a slacker in creased black jeans and a faded green sweatshirt from the University of Notre Dame. The clerical collar seemed at odds with the cowboy boots. A man of contradictions. A kindred spirit.
"We're not exactly having a rush on salvation today," he said. "With weather like this, I reckon folks figure they'll take their chances," Jay reasoned. "What's another day or two in purgatory, give or take?"
"You know about purgatory, Mr. Brooks? Are you Catholic?"
"No, sir. I was born a Baptist, and later converted to cynicism, but I do know all about purgatory."
Weariness crept into his voice against his will.
"Y'all haven't cornered the market on hell or its suburbs."
Father Tom tipped his head in concession.
"No, I suppose not. Did you want to go into my office?"
Jay shook his head. His gaze scanned the grand interior of the church, taking in the windows, the statuary, the cast bas-relief plaques that hung at regular intervals along the wall.
"This is fine. Quite a place you've got here."
The altar was traditional, draped in linen, set with brass candelabra, a gleaming chalice, a huge old book with marker ribbons trailing from between its pages. According to the newspaper articles from 1 week ago, the demented deacon had given Father McCoy a concussion with one of the brass candlesticks from that altar. Jay wondered if it was sitting up there now, absolved of guilt, or if the police had taken it away as evidence. From the huge crucifix that hung behind the altar, the delicately carved face of Christ glowered down at him as if in disapproval of his thoughts. Father Tom moved farther down the pew. Jay sat beside him, his parka rustling like newspaper. He had unzipped it as a concession to being indoors, but the cold seemed to have sunk into him bone deep in the 10 minutes it had taken him to get there, navigating the Cherokee along unplowed roads and through 3-foot drifts. At any rate, the church didn't seem as warm as the interior of the truck. The thermostat probably went up only for parishioners. No sense heating the barn when the flock was gone. "You're here to do a book," Father Tom said flatly. "You disapprove." "It's not my place to approve or disapprove." A smile cracked Jay's face. "Well, I've never known that to stop anybody." "Hannah and Josh have been through enough," McCoy said without apology. "I don't want to see them hurt any more than they already have been." Jay arched a brow at the omission. "And Paul?" The priest glanced away. "Paul has made it clear he doesn't want anything from me or the church." "Can you blame him?" "Not for that." His candor was surprising, but then, nothing much about Tom McCoy seemed ordinary. Depending on who you asked around town, Father McCoy was a rebel, refreshing, an affront to the traditions of the church. He did not define himself by uniform or convention. His parishioners either loved him or tolerated him. Behind the lenses of his gold-rimmed glasses, his blue eyes were honest. "I'm not interested in exploiting victims, Father." "You'll record their suffering, dissect their lives, package their story as entertainment, and make a whole lot of money. What do you call that?" "The way of the world. Stuff happens. People want to know about it. Their knowing doesn't change what happened. Nothing can. What I'm after is the truth. Reasons. Motives. I want to know where ordinary people find the strength to deal with extraordinary tragedy. I want to know what the rest of us can learn from them. And make a lot of money." "And make a lot of money," he admitted. "The poor might be rich in the kingdom of God, but I'll take mine now, thanks." "Hannah isn't ordinary," Father Tom said. His expression softened slightly, tellingly. "Ask anyone. She's stronger than she knows. Kind. Good. I can't begin to tell you what she's meant to this community as a doctor, as a role model." "It must have been difficult to see her go through this," Jay offered, watching closely for the true reaction. Anger. There and gone. Quickly veiled by something more acceptable. But there was no priestly wisdom forthcoming. No magic motto meant as a blanket banality for all-purpose suffering. "It's been hell," McCoy said frankly. "I've been a priest for more than a decade, Mr. Brooks. I have yet to understand why bad things happen to good people."
"God's will?" Jay ventured.
"I certainly hope not. What purpose is served punishing the faithful and the innocent? I'd call that sadism, wouldn't you?"
Jay leaned back and crossed his arms, regarding Tom McCoy with a quizzical scrutiny.
"Are you sure you're a priest?"
He gave a humorless laugh and looked away. The word no reverberated in the air around him.
"After the last couple of weeks, I don't think any of us can be sure of anything."
The answer struck a chord. Truth, the kind nobody really wanted to hear.
"But you must see this all the time," McCoy said. "It's your job, going from one set of victims to another. Does it get to you, or are you immune?"
"Not immune. Careful. I keep my distance. Don't let it get personal. I'm there to ask questions, look for answers, patch it all together and move on."
Even as he rattled off his stock answer, he could see Ellen in his mind's eye. He could feel her in his arms, feel her fear, her tears soaking into his shirt. Some distance.
"It's not about me," he said.
That was a lie, too.
He might have called coming to Deer Lake running away, but he couldn't escape the fact that immersing himself in this particular case was certainly about him, about his own sense of loss. It was about punishing and comforting himself with perspective, which made him both selfish and opportunistic. Why couldn't he have just jumped on a plane to Barbados after seeing Christine? He could have been soaking up sun and rum instead of freezing his ass and digging up unwanted emotions out of the deepest corners of his soul.
"I'm just recording the story," he stated, as if that could make it so.
"Nothing personal," Father Tom said. His gaze had narrowed, focusing deeper than the surface excuses and public facade. "Do you have children?"
"Depends on who you ask," he thought,
but he kept that answer to himself. Confession was for the regulars of St. Aloysius, not smart-mouth mercenary hacks from out of town. McCoy interpreted the silence as a no. "Have you met Hannah and Josh?"
"Not yet."
"Why is that? The story is about their lives."
"There are other people involved. I've been busy getting background, getting to know the players."
"Really?
If you're waiting for me to say it didn't seem right to approach her, you'll be waiting a long time, Father," he said, wondering just how many strikes God would list against him for lying to a priest.
He had been avoiding Hannah Garrison on the excuse that the story was about more than her son. It was about the court system and the cops and Garrett Wright and Dennis Enberg. But at its heart, it was about a little boy, an 8-year-old boy who had had his whole life pulled up by the roots. He had chosen this story specifically for the parallels, to force himself to examine the pain and to probe the questions while maintaining his usual safe distance. And he had shied away from the heart of it. Josh. Josh, who was 8 years old, freckle-faced, gap-toothed, who liked to play hockey in Little League. He remembered the picture in Paul's office, Josh in his baseball uniform with Paul, the proud father beside him. The fist of longing tightened.
"What the hell are you doing here, Brooks?"
Father Tom rose to his feet. "Let's take a ride, Mr. Brooks. There's someone I think you should meet." They drove down Lake Shore, past Garrett Wright's home with a few intrepid reporters parked out front, onto the Kirkwood house, and turned in the driveway. Jay had parked in front of this house once before, only to back off and drive away. Nothing had changed in the few days in between. The snow fort in the front yard was still half-finished. He wondered if Josh would ever finish it, or if what he had gone through had so changed him that something as simple and childish as a snow fort would forevermore seem unimportant. Father Tom stepped out of the Cherokee. Jay gave a cursory glance at his mini-cassette recorder lying on the console between the seats and left it. They walked up the driveway together, Jay quietly absorbing the feel of the place, the detail. The house was the last one on the block. It looked comfortable, the kind of place to raise a family. From the front step, the view of the street and the rest of the neighborhood was limited, cut off by the attached garage that jutted out in front of the house itself. The view was of the lake, and the trees that lined the banks. Through the lacework of leafless branches and across the frozen expanse, the buildings of Harris College were just visible. It was on this step that Josh Kirkwood had been left 4 nights ago, alone, dressed in a pair of striped pajamas. His mother had seen no one, no car. Garrett Wright's house was just down the block, but as yet no evidence had been found to suggest Josh had ever been inside it. Karen Wright had been under guard that night at the Fontaine Hotel. Who had brought him back? Todd Childs? Christopher Priest? Or was Wright's accomplice someone so anonymous he or she was able to move around town freely, unknown, unseen, unsuspected? And what was the connection to Wright, or was the connection to the people who lived in this house? Hannah Garrison opened the door, a smile lighting her face when she saw Father Tom. "You forgot your gloves again," she chided. "If you don't end up with frostbite, it'll be a miracle."
"Well, that would certainly improve my stock with the bishop."
Hannah had been the less visible one during the ordeal, staying in the background while her husband joined the search teams and played to the press. But Jay had watched her one television interview enough times that he had already memorized the sound of her voice, the cadence of her speech, the cornflower blue of her eyes. He knew she blamed herself, because she hadn't been there to pick Josh up that night. He had seen the pain in her face, heard the confusion in her voice. She'd had the perfect life, and suddenly it was broken all around her. And he wanted to write a book about it.
"J. Butler Brooks, ma'am," he said, offering his hand.
The pretty, fragile smile went brittle, and her gaze cut to her friend, Father Tom. "I thought it was important," was all he said.
"I'm not a reporter, ma'am," Jay said.
Hannah lifted her chin, her gaze cool. "I know what you are, Mr. Brooks." "Come in," she said. She directed them not into the family room where the television was on and toys were scattered across the floor, but into a formal dining room with furniture that likely hadn't been used since Christmas. She was distancing him from her real home, from her children. Jay accepted the subtle slight as part of the big picture, part of the whole story, part of who Hannah Garrison was. She took the seat at the head of the table, even though she looked as if she had been ill, thin, pale, with dark circles beneath her eyes. Her bearing was regal. Her wavy golden hair was pulled back from her face, accenting the kind of bone structure that made fashion models wealthy. But she wore no makeup, no jewelry. Her sweatshirt was a well-worn relic from her alma mater, Duke University. She could have made a gunny sack look chic.
"My husband told me he'd spoken with you," she said.
"Why does that make me think I've already got a strike against me?"
"Certainly you have in Paul's eyes. I make my own judgments." Jay nodded.
"That's fair. I've been told you're a remarkable woman, Dr. Garrison."
She moved one long, elegant hand in a dismissive gesture. "By circumstance, that's all. Which is why you're here, isn't it?"
"I won't lie to you about that, Dr. Garrison. I'm a writer. You've got a hell of a story here. I'd like the chance to tell it."
"And if I decline, you'll tell it anyway?"
"Probably. I'd like to be able to include your perspective, but it's up to you whether or not you want to participate."
"Well, that was simple. My answer is no. Living this nightmare once is quite enough. I don't have any desire to go through it again in retelling the tale to you, or in thinking thousands of people will live it vicariously, reading your book."
"Not even if it might help someone to understand..."
"Understand what?" "No part of this is understandable. I know. I've spent every night, every day, trying to understand. All I've got for the effort is more questions."
"There will be a considerable amount of money for Josh," Jay said.
He found it very telling that Hannah herself hadn't spoken a word about payment when it had been virtually the first thought in her husband's head. She gave him a frosty look. "I won't prostitute my son or myself, Mr. Brooks. We don't need your money. All I want is to get away from this nightmare, for us to distance ourselves from it emotionally and get on with our lives. Any money associated with what happened would only be like dragging the experience with us. It would be like blood money." She stood and smoothed her hands along the baggy hem of her sweatshirt. "No, that's my answer. Would you like coffee?" Subject dismissed, on to obligatory hostess duties. Jay had the feeling that if he had come here a month ago, Hannah would have been softer, gentler, less blunt, more elaborate in her guise of good manners. The ordeal had pared away the unnecessary in her, cut away the crap of social ceremony, leaving only the honest, the essential. Like many people he had interviewed, people who had gone through harrowing experiences, Hannah had seen how much of life is just bullshit, just meaningless ritual made important to give humankind some pretense of being better than the rest of the animals on the planet. In another part of the house, a telephone rang. She excused herself to answer it.
"The trust fund will be set up," he said to Father Tom. "They can do what they want with the money. Give it away, for all I care."
The priest gave a lazy shrug.
"It doesn't matter to you. You've absolved yourself, done your part, paid your fee."
"I can't win for losing around here," Jay grumbled. "If I kept every nickel for myself,
I'd be a greedy son of a bitch. If I give it away, I'm trying to buy a conscience. Are you?
He barked a laugh and looked away. What the hell would he want with a conscience? It was just excess baggage, another rock around his neck to drag him down. If he had a conscience, he would have to believe that it was all his own fault, that Christine had kept his son from him all these years, that it wasn't just virulent spite on her part. He heard enough as it was. To think it was his own doing that had taken 8 years of his son's life away from him, denied him even the knowledge of the boy, would be too much. A mop of sandy brown hair and a pair of big blue eyes suddenly appeared in the doorway to the family room. The eyes were somber, with a steady stare. "Hi, Josh," Father Tom said in a casual voice. "Would you like to join us?" The boy eased the rest of his body into view, but kept one hand on the door jamb. The other clutched the handle of a bulging nylon backpack. He was dressed in baggy blue jeans and a Blackhawks hockey jersey, several sizes too big. He made no move to come forward. Jay turned sideways on his chair and rested his forearms on his thighs.
"Hey there, Josh," he said quietly. "My name's Jay. Your dad tells me you're quite the baseball player."
Josh's expression didn't flicker. There was no relaxation at the mention of his father, no response at all. He had a face made for a mischievous grin. Jay remembered the smile from the photograph in Paul's office, shining eyes and shy pride. And the photograph from the missing posters, a gap-toothed grin, and a Cub Scout uniform. Slowly Josh crossed the hall and came into the dining room, skirting all the way around the room, his eyes on Jay. When he was even with Father Tom, he stopped and dug a spiral notebook out of the backpack, opened it, and tore out a page.
"I guess hockey is the sport now,"
Jay went on, making conversation to break the tension that filled the room, hoping he might strike the right chord and draw the boy out.
"We don't play much hockey where I come from. We don't have any winter to speak of."
Josh paid no attention to him, as he knelt on the floor and carefully folded the sheet of paper in half, and in half again. When he was finished, he stood, hooked his backpack over one shoulder, and walked a straight line across the area rug, as if he were on a tightrope. When he reached the table, he held the paper out for Father Tom.
"For me?"
he asked, accepting the gift. Josh nodded.
"But don't open it now."
"All right."
He slid the note into an inner pocket.
"I'll save it for later."
The boy nodded again, scooted behind Father Tom, and scurried along the edge of the room again to the doorway, watching Jay with those big, somber eyes. Hannah came back, pausing to touch her son's head. Josh ducked out from under the caress and disappeared into the family room.
"I'm sorry for the interruption," she said. "Did you decide about the coffee?"
Jay rose.
"No, thank you, ma'am. I've got to be going."
He dug a card out of one of the many pockets on his parka and handed it to her.
"In case you change your mind."
"I won't," she said firmly, but tempered it with an apologetic look. She was a far cry from her husband. Their marriage would be a story in itself, he supposed. Which of them had changed for better or worse? How long would they have hung on if Josh's abduction hadn't pulled them apart?
"It was a pleasure meeting you, Hannah," he said. "Father Tom is right. You're an extraordinary person, whether you care to think it or not."
A deep sadness darkened her eyes.
"But that's just my point, Mr. Brooks. I don't want to be a heroine. I just want our lives back."
It didn't look as if she would get that any time soon, he thought with pity, when he stepped out through the front door and a photographer shot his picture from the window of a Toyota parked on the street.
"She doesn't deserve what's happened to her,"
Father Tom said, once inside the Cherokee. Wasn't it the role of priests to listen to their faithful, ponder the cruelties of the world? Jay thought. Tom McCoy seemed to have more questions than answers, a burden that appeared to be weighing on him heavily.
"In my experience, Father," Jay said, "life is scattershot with random acts of cruelty. Trying to make sense of it either keeps us human or makes us crazy."
Father Tom said nothing,
but slipped Josh's note out of his coat pocket and unfolded it. The drawing was simple. A sad face, with blank, dark eyes, set in the center of an inked-in black square. The caption broke his heart. "When I was lost." Josh wasn't the only one who had been lost in this ordeal. Lost lives, lost love, lost trust. Lost faith. Tom had tried to make sense of it, had prayed for some comfort, but all he felt was fear as the faith that had anchored his life slipped farther and farther away, and all he wanted to hold on to was another man's wife. "When I was lost." He folded the page and tucked it back into his coat pocket. The funeral dragged on interminably. Victor Franken had accumulated scores of acquaintances in his 79 years, none of whom were shy about using his death as an excuse to show off their skills as orators. The weather had prevented those from any distance outstate from coming, which the locals interpreted as meaning more time on the pulpit for themselves. Ellen sat toward the back of Grace Lutheran, fanning herself with her program, wondering if all the hot air was coming from the furnace or if it was simply a byproduct of this many lawyers in one place. The narthex was crowded with reporters, lying in wait to jump people for comments on their way out. Franken's relatives sat in the front pews, including the great-grandson from L.A., who had opened the ceremonies with an interpretive liturgical dance that made the locals squirm in their seats. Minnesotans rarely interpreted anything with their bodies, and never clad in a black unitard. Life in Deer Lake had taken on all the weirder qualities of a Fellini film, with Rudy Stovich as the sad clown. He stood at the pulpit, his voice rising and falling as dramatically as his expressions. Mike Lumpkin, an attorney from Tatanka, leaned into Ellen and whispered, "If he's like this on the bench, I'm going into real estate." "Cross your fingers," she whispered back. "Maybe he'll be discovered by television. He could be the next Wapner. Who'll play Rusty? Manly Van Loon. Sounds like an episode of Hee-Haw," he said with a grimace. "Hey, we need to talk dispo on Tillman. What do you think about time served?" "I think you're dreaming. Time served in 80 hours of community service." His eyes bugged out. 80? 90? 60? 100? 80 sounds good," he said reasonably, and sat back as Rudy launched into the last leg of his tribute. Ellen stifled a sigh. She tried to block everything around her from her mind in order to give Judge Franken her own personal tribute. Brief and to the point. He was a good man, a good judge. He would be missed. The burial had to be postponed until a good thaw. After the final prayer and three verses of "Abide with Me," everyone trooped to the church basement for cake and jello from the Lutheran Ladies' Auxiliary and conversation that centered not on Judge Franken, but on Garrett Wright and the kidnappings. Ellen made one obligatory round of the room and escaped through a little-used side door that led out onto the parking lot. By the time she made it back to the courthouse, those who had remained behind to conduct business were closing down for the night and for the weekend. Coats were going on, computers and typewriters turning off, pumps going into tote bags while feet were sliding into snow boots. Quentin Adler stood with briefcase in hand, talking at Martha, their receptionist. "I would have gone to pay my respects, but I'm up to my ears in work," he stated importantly. "You know, Rudy asked me to take on some of Ellen's cases." Ellen rolled her eyes and ducked behind him, heading to Phoebe's desk. Her secretary sat with her woolly poncho across her lap, her expression that of a third grader who was being made to stay late after school. "Do I have any messages?" Ellen asked, pretending not to notice the pout. "Your mail is on your desk. Someone sent you roses. Pete Eklund wants to cut a deal on Zimmerman. A gazillion reporters called. Agent Wilhelm says toxicology shows traces of triazolam in Josh Kirkwood's bloodstream," she recited, thrusting the slips up at Ellen. "Do I have to stay?" "Got a hot date?" Ellen raised her brows, trying for girlish camaraderie. "Not anymore." "No, you don't have to stay." Ellen dropped her gaze to the note from Wilhelm and tried not to feel like an evil stepmother. "But we could use your help tomorrow afternoon." Ignoring the hefty sigh, she went into her office. Triazolam. She went directly to the bookcase and pulled a reference book that listed virtually every drug, legal and otherwise, known to mankind. Triazolam, better known as Halcyon. A central nervous system depressant, once commonly prescribed as a sleeping pill, also commonly used in psych wards. She scanned the list of side effects that included memory loss and hallucinations. When withdrawn suddenly, there may be bizarre personality changes, psychosis, and paranoia. That might have been one explanation for Josh's behavior, she thought. A strong enough dose could have kept Josh in a hypnotic state during his captivity, during which time Wright could have planted anything in his mind, including threats. Taking him abruptly off the drug might have set off a mild psychosis. She dialed Wilhelm's number and noticed for the first time the bouquet of red roses in an all-purpose green office vase. Brooks was her first thought. The bastard thought he could ease past her guard with flowers and that damned smile. He and Costello had probably had a good chuckle, strategizing about her over drinks. Sandwiching the receiver between her shoulder and ear, she plucked the note card out from between the thorny stems and tore it open. "Agent Wilhelm." "Ellen North here. Thanks for calling about the tox report," she said. "It might answer some questions for us." "I've got people looking into prescriptions for Halcyon filled locally," he said. "We might get lucky. Then again, it might have been filled in Minneapolis, where there must be a couple hundred pharmacies." "Gotta start somewhere," Ellen said. "Have you got a report on O'Malley's blood tests? She believed Wright injected her with something while she was unconscious. If we could get a line on both drugs." The rustle of paper sounded like static over the phone. "Hang on." Ellen opened the note card. A folded piece of paper dropped out. The card itself was blank. "Odd." Ellen set the card aside and opened the folded paper. "Evil comes to she who searches for it. Search S for sin. See where we've been." Ellen dropped the note and shot up out of her chair, jumping back from the desk. The telephone receiver clattered down over the drawer fronts and dangled. "Ms. North, are you there? Ms. North? Hello?" "Search S for sin. See where we've been." "Oh, God," she whispered, looking wildly around her office, her sanctuary, the one place in her professional life she felt she had absolute control. Her gaze landed on the filing cabinets. "Search S for sin." Shaking, she jerked the drawer open and flipped through the files. One stood out, cleaner, stiffer, unworn, the word sin in bold caps on the tab. He'd been in her office. The son of a bitch had been in her office. She lay the file atop the others in the open cabinet and turned the cover back. Staring up at her from the small square of a Polaroid snapshot, blank-eyed and expressionless, was Josh Kirkwood. Chapter 22. The day had seemed to last forever, and yet night fell too soon. The contradiction, Hannah thought, was just a reflection of her own inner turmoil. She had been gone from the hospital longer than 2 weeks. She couldn't imagine leaving Josh and Lily, and yet she missed her work terribly. She missed the place and the people, her patients, her co-workers, her friends, the normalcy of routine, the drudgery of paperwork. Most of all, she missed who she was at work. The strength of mind and will she wore in that role seemed to have come off with a white lab coat and the fake brass name tag. She would never have said she defined herself by her job. It wasn't who she was, it was what she did. But without the frame of reference it provided, she felt lost. And with the feeling of loss came guilt. She wasn't only a doctor. She was a mother. Her children needed her. Why could she not define herself in those terms? The curse of the 90s woman, she thought, struggling for a sense of humor. A futile struggle. The day had held little to laugh about, and was only going to get worse. The weather had forced her to cancel Josh's appointment with Dr. Freeman. A friend from the hospital had called and told her Dr. Lomax was beginning to make noises to the administration about officially naming him temporary director of the ER, a condition he would then fight to make permanent. Director of the ER, the promotion that had passed over his head and landed squarely on Hannah's shoulders just a month ago. She worried that they might actually listen to him, then raked herself over the mental coals for letting anything but Josh's situation take precedence in her mind. Ellen North had called to tell her they had another piece of physical evidence against Wright, but that Garrett Wright's attorney wanted access to Josh's medical records, a ploy meant to divert attention away from Wright and onto Paul. And J. Butler Brooks wanted to write a book about it all. Hell of a day. Costello's charge occupied her mind like a big black rat chewing at her nerves. The implication was that Paul had abused Josh, a charge that she had rejected out of hand. Paul would never intentionally hurt his children. He didn't even believe in spanking. And yet how many times lately had she been struck by the horrible sensation that he had become a stranger? He had lied to her, lied to the police, evaded questions, and twisted non-answers into self-righteous outrage. She remembered too well how Megan O'Malley had questioned her about Paul after Josh's jacket had been found on Ryan's Bay. "When did you start to notice a change in him? He's been withdrawing more recently? Does he normally ignore his answering machine when you call him at the office at night?" "Why are you asking me these questions? You can't possibly think Paul had something to do with this. It's just routine. Mother Teresa would need an alibi if she were here. When we catch this guy, his lawyer will probably try to pin it on someone else. If he's sleazy enough, he'll ask you where you were, and where Paul was." "I don't know where Paul was. He was gone when I woke up. He said he went out on his own, just driving around town, looking." She didn't know where he had been that morning, or why he hadn't called her back the night Josh went missing, or why he had lied to police about once owning a light-colored van. She didn't know why Josh had recoiled from him that night in the hospital. Another tide of guilt rose into her throat. It wasn't that she believed Paul was capable of any of it. It was that she couldn't be sure he wasn't. She knew that he was coming to dinner, that he would be there in a matter of minutes. She had managed to prepare the meal, even though her attention had been fractured. The salad had been tossed. The scent of rosemary chicken and roasting potatoes filled the air. In the family room, Lily was stacking blocks in a precarious tower. Josh had built himself a fort with chairs and footstools and couch cushions, creating a space he could go into and shut everyone else out. Hannah had herded him out of his bedroom every day to prevent him from doing just that. Shutting her out, shutting himself in with the memories he refused to share. The fort reminded her he could keep the rest of the world out without walls, with only his silence. He had spent the better part of the day in his new burrow, with his backpack and his new ThinkPad. Hannah had been relieved to see him making use of the notebook. Perhaps memories and feelings would start flowing onto the pages, then spill over and out of him, and he would begin to talk about what he had been through. Ellen had asked about him, whether or not he seemed to be opening up. Hannah knew it would help the case against Garrett Wright, but there was no pushing Josh, as tempting as it might have been. Dr. Freeman said Josh had to come to it in his own time, that trying to force him to talk about what had happened could trigger a trauma from which he might not recover for months or years. He needed time. The probable cause hearing began on Tuesday. She stepped down from the kitchen into the family room. "Josh, time to get cleaned up for supper. Dad will be here any minute." Josh peered up at her from under the couch cushion roof of his little hut. He had said nothing one way or the other about Paul's intended visit. Paul had called mid-morning. He wanted to see the children, especially Josh. He had always been so proud of Josh, so pleased to have a son. His own father had never taken much interest in his bookish younger son, preferring the company of Paul's older brothers. To have Josh reject him had to hurt unbearably. "Come on," she said, lifting the cushion. Josh slapped his ThinkPad shut and clutched it to his chest. Hannah leaned down, brushing a hand over his sandy curls. "Dad's really looking forward to seeing you," she said. "He misses you and Lily." Josh said nothing. He had yet even to ask why his father was no longer living in the house. His lack of curiosity unnerved her. Beyond the kitchen, a door opened and closed, Paul coming in from the garage. Josh's eyes widened, and he bolted like a deer, jumping out of his fort and running for the hall that led to the bathroom and bedrooms. Lily smashed her blocks down and dashed in a mad circle around the living room, squealing, "Daddy! Daddy!"
"I forgot the ice cream,"
Paul announced as he stepped into the kitchen. The tone was challenging, defensive. In truth, he hadn't forgotten at all. After Costello's announcement had been splashed all over the news, he hadn't been able to bring himself to go into a store. People would stare at him, think God knew what. They would forget all about him putting in hours on the search, making pleas on television. They would think back to the day Mitch Holt had told him to come in to be fingerprinted. They would remember O'Malley ragging about that goddamn van. Lily scrambled up the steps into the kitchen. Her little face wreathed in smiles.
"Daddy! Daddy!"
She flung herself at his legs, and Paul scooped her up, perching her in the crook of his arm.
"Well, at least someone is glad to see me."
"Don't worry about dessert," Hannah said. "People are still bringing food to the house. We've got enough brownies to last into the next millennium." Lily looped her arms around his neck and lay her head down on his shoulder.
"Daddy home! 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 My daddy!"
Paul brushed an absent kiss across her forehead and set her down on the kitchen floor.
"Where's Josh?"
He unbuttoned his long wool topcoat and went to hang it in his office. "He's getting washed up," she answered, carrying the salad bowl to the table, stepping around Lily, who had seated herself in the middle of the floor, lower lip trembling threateningly.
"Has he said anything?"
"No."
"What the hell is that psychiatrist doing, besides charging us $150 an hour?"
Hannah's eyes flashed impatience as she turned toward the stove. "She's a psychiatrist, not a plumber. She can't just roto-rooter out his memory. It's going to take time." She bent down to reach for Lily. The baby twisted away from her and began to sob.
"Daddy!"
"Meanwhile, Anthony Costello is going to make me out to be some kind of child abuser. Did you hear about that?"
Hannah bit back the remark that burned on the tip of her tongue. Once again, Paul had managed to make this about him. What would people think of him? How would this inconvenient delay in Josh's recovery affect him?
"Yes, I heard," Ellen North called.
"Sure," Paul sneered. "She can't manage to stop it from happening, but she can handle calling around to dispense the bad news. You know, it really pisses me off that the county attorney isn't handling this himself. What is it with him? We're not important enough for him to bother with? Have we finally stumbled onto someone who doesn't worship the great Dr. Garrison as a goddess?"
"Stop right there, Paul.
Just drop it,"
she said sharply.
"You're here to see the kids. We're going to be a family tonight. I don't care what it takes. We're going to at least pretend we haven't grown to hate each other. No sniping, no snide remarks, no poor put-upon Paul. Do you understand me? Have I made that clear enough? We're going to be a family tonight," she declared. "Now pick up your daughter and pay some attention to her while I go get Josh."
She turned away from him, and her heart stopped. Josh stood at the foot of the steps, face scrubbed, hair damp, blue eyes wide and somber, backpack clutched to his chest. Lily let out another wail. Paul abandoned her, turning toward his son instead, a brittle grin stretching across his face like a crack in a plaster wall.
"Hey, Josh! How you doing, slugger?"
As Paul descended the steps, Josh backpedaled. Hannah watched them, frozen at the kitchen counter. Lily's plaintive squalling stabbed into her brain like an ice pick, but she couldn't bring herself to tend to her daughter. Her gaze was riveted on the scene before her.
"I've missed you, son," Paul said in a wheedling voice. "Won't you let your old dad give you a hug?"
Josh shook his head, taking another step back, his arms tightening around his backpack.
"Paul, don't push it,"
Hannah said with gentle desperation, for all the good it would do. Already she knew he wouldn't listen, that he would try too hard and ruin his chance and whatever fragile hope she had held for a normal family evening. He moved toward Josh, bending over, reaching out.
"Josh, come here."
"No."
"Josh, please."
"No."
"Damn it, Josh, I'm your father. Come here."
He lunged for Josh's arm. Josh twisted out of reach, dropped to the floor, and scooted inside his furniture fort, dragging his backpack with him. Hannah launched herself into the family room, grabbing Paul's arm, holding him back from pursuit. He looked at her, his face a contorted mask of hurt and disbelief.
"He's my son," he said in a tortured whisper. "Why is he doing this to me?"
Hannah closed her eyes and put her head on his shoulder, hugging him, because it had once been a natural thing to do, apologizing for reasons